So we're very, very privileged to have him speak to us today. Thank you very much, Craig Murray.
Thank you. I usually get better applause before I start, but when I finish it, I've got sort of 4 minutes to talk to you, which isn't a tremendous amount of time to fit a lot in. If you feel you would like more detail, you can buy my book. I have no shame about being commercial, because I don't have an income anymore. You're very welcome to buy it. It makes a wonderful Christmas present, because you can read it yourself before you give it to someone, and you can give it to someone who believes in human rights, and they'll be delighted. If you give it to a new Labour supporter, and they'll be really annoyed, which is worth doing at Christmas. And I'll sign it for you. I was British ambassador in Uzbekistan. I turned up in August of 2002. It was my first ambassadorial post. And I knew Uzbekistan was a dictatorship. I'd been told it wasn't too much changed from the Soviet system. But I really wasn't prepared for how dictatorial it was. It's a totalitarian state. There's no freedom whatsoever. Opposition political parties are banned. They don't dig the elections, they don't allow the opposition to contest them. There's absolutely no free media, no freedom of assembly. Amnesty International reckon there are 7,000 political prisoners. I think that's probably an underestimate. There's no freedom of the internet, for example. And the people, the majority of the population, work on state farms producing cotton. Uzbekistan is the world's second largest exporter of cotton. See, irrigation for the Uzbek cotton industry, which has caused the destruction of the Aral Sea. And the people who work on the cotton farms, they work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, and the salary they actually get when they get it, their official salary, is $12 a month. What they actually get in their hands is $2 a month. Imagine that, 7 cents a day for working 12 hours a day. And they can't leave, they're slaves. Not only does Uzbekistan still have an external visa system for leaving the country, they have an internal visa system. If you want to move from one village to another village, you need a visa. And if you're a cotton worker, you won't get it, because they want to keep you on the cotton farms. In the harvest season, the schools and universities are all closed. The students and the teachers and the lecturers are sent out to harvest cotton as well. Children of 7 and 8 years old work back-breaking 12-hour days in the cotton fields for months on end. And I was under instructions, as I arrived there as ambassador, always to, whenever I spoke in public, refer to Uzbekistan as our ally in the war on terror. And always start my speech by thanking President Karimov for his assistance in Afghanistan and for giving the United States an air base, which they were leasing in Kashi, Karnabad. I found it difficult, given the nature of the regime, to always say this. I decided to try and find out more. I'd been there a couple of weeks when I attended a dissident trial. The trial was of 6 people who were charged with membership of the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, a movement said, with some justice, to be linked to Al-Qaeda. They were charged with the armed robbery of a jeweler to fund terrorism, with the murder of 2 policemen. I learned from Human Rights Watch that 12 other people had already been convicted of the murder of the 2 policemen. And there's no accusation that it was a mob or a conspiracy. Quite simply, 2 policemen had been murdered. When that happens, the Uzbek government uses it to round up a lot of dissidents and try them, and if it's murder, execute them.
Please. I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Your face, sir, is half white and half red with the light, the way you're standing.
Is it?
Could you possibly stand over there and we can see your beautiful face? Thank you so much, sir.
I don't like microphones, but I will move here. It could be my face is naturally half white and black.
Is it light, sir?
Thank you, sir. I was stunned. I attended this trial. I can only compare it to footage I've seen of Hitler's show trials. The accused looked beaten and emaciated. The judge was screaming and yelling at them, making gratuitous anti-Islamic remarks. For example, I'm surprised you could find time to commit all these crimes when you had to stop to pray 5 times a day. and all his cronies in the court would laugh, as though this was great wit. But one particular incident happened in that courtroom which started me on my first step on the path that led me out of the diplomatic service and led me here today. One old man was giving evidence. He had given a written statement to police to say that two of the accused, who were his nephews, were members of Al-Qaeda, had travelled to Afghanistan and had met with Osama bin Laden in person. And he was giving his evidence, and like everyone else in that courtroom, he was terrified. He was an old man, and you could see he was scared stiff. But suddenly he seemed to find an inner strength, and he stood taller, and he said, "This is not true. This is not true. They tortured my children in front of me until I signed this statement. We are good Muslims, but we are poor farmers from Andijan. What do we know about Osama bin Laden?" And I can't entirely explain it to you, because it's partly intuitive. But at that moment, I was a yard from him. I could have touched him. And I could just tell that was the truth. He was speaking the truth. And he must have realized that in doing that, he was almost certainly signing his own death warrant. That, you know, gave me pause to think. And everything else I was learning was giving me pause to think. I reported that trial and everything I'd seen in detail back to London. And I received a reply from the Foreign Office, which I will never forget. It said, "Dear Ambassador, the Secretary of State is concerned that you are perhaps over-focused on human rights." Anyway, I continued to be over-focused on human rights. The fact that the British ambassador had been to a dissident trial was a kind of day of hope to the dissidents in Uzbekistan, the oppressed, because the West had been totally ignoring them because of their position as an ally in the war on terror. Think about it. Before, and unless you received some specific information from Amnesty International, and even then there wasn't much of that, in 1999, 2000, 2001, when did you hear about human rights in Uzbekistan? Almost never. These people felt ignored. Once they found, to their astonishment, that the British Embassy was taking an interest, people started to beat a path to my door. Victims of torture, relatives of victims of torture, people with photographic evidence of torture, even people with letters smuggled out of the gulags. And we began to build up a picture of torture carried out on an industrial scale, affecting thousands of people a year. One of the first things I received was an envelope containing photographs of the dead body. This man was a member of Hizbut Tahrir, the fundamentalist but non-violent Islamic group. He'd been in the Jazlik gulag, when his body had been returned to his mother with instructions not to open the casket but to bury it the next day. But she felt there were certain religious duties to be performed by way of washing the body. So in the middle of the night, she got the body out and onto the kitchen table. When she saw the condition, she took photographs of it. And eventually, when she heard the British Embassy was now taking an interest in human rights, she got them to us. When I saw them, I couldn't work out what had happened to this corpse. I'd seen nothing like it in my life. So I sent them to the pathology department of the University of Glasgow. They did a report based on these detailed photos, and their report said that his fingernails had been pulled out, he'd been beaten about the face and the neck, and he died of immersion in boiling liquid. And it was immersion, not splashing, because there was a clear tide line around the upper limbs and upper torso, and 100% scalding underneath. He'd been boiled alive. I only came across one or two other examples of people being boiled alive that I could definitely verify. But people having a limb inserted into boiling liquid was very common, as was suffocation, as was beating, particularly the smashing of the knees and elbows, as was rape. And extremely common was the torture or the rape of family members in front of the person. But as we gathered all this evidence, which London kept telling me they didn't want every time I sent it to them, we also got evidence of what people were being forced to confess to under torture. They were being forced to confess to membership of Al-Qaeda. They were often being forced to confess to going to Afghanistan and meeting Osama bin Laden in person. And they were being forced to sign up to long lists of names of other people and say, "Yes, I know these are also members of Al-Qaeda." More often than not, they had no idea who any of the people in these lists of names were, and they were by no means all Uzbeks. People were being tortured in Uzbek cells and admitting that all kinds of people who they didn't know all over the world were Al-Qaeda members. Now, at the same time, I was seeing all the CIA intelligence coming out of Uzbekistan, because under the UK-US intelligence sharing agreement, MI6 and CIA share all their intelligence. Now, I didn't have any intelligence to share. I don't want to spoil the new James Bond film for you, but we didn't have an MI6 station in Tashkent because it was too dangerous. In real life, MI6 do not serve in countries where you can't buy a cappuccino. Very aristocratic organization. But I saw the CIA material. What did the CIA material say? It said that detainees had confessed to being members of Al-Qaeda. It said they had traveled to Afghanistan and met Osama bin Laden, and it gave long lists of names of other people as members of Al-Qaeda. It wasn't difficult to put two and two together and work out that this material came direct from the Uzbek torture chambers and was being passed to the CIA from the Uzbek security service. It particularly wasn't difficult to work it out because we asked the American embassy and they said, yes, it almost certainly is from the Uzbek torture chambers, we get it from the Uzbek security services, and we don't see that as a problem in the context of the war on terror. I did see it as a problem, and I reported back to London by telegrams to Jack Straw saying, we're getting intelligence from torture. It's illegal, it's immoral, and it's useless because the information's no good. It became increasingly plain to me that London were pretty angry with me. I was summoned back to a meeting which took place on either the 7th or the 8th of March 2003, whichever of those is a Friday. And at that meeting I was told three things. Sir Michael Wood, the Foreign Office's chief legal advisor, told me it is not illegal for us to get intelligence under torture as long as we don't do the torturing ourselves. Okay. The second thing I was told, and told me back as the Foreign Office's chief legal advisor. The second thing I was told was that Jack Straw had met with Sir Richard Dearlove, the head of MI6, and they had decided that in the context of the war on terror, we should obtain intelligence through torture as a matter of policy, and that that policy had been confirmed by the cabinet. So I was a civil servant, and I should shut up and get on with it. Now, those are two very chilling things to tell you. But the third thing, in a sense, is even more chilling, because when I said that the information is untrue, it's rubbish, why do we want it? There was a guy representing MI6, his name was Matthew Kidd, who was speaking very, very carefully from the prepared written brief, not deviating at all from the official line. And every time I said to him, it's untrue information, he said, it's operationally useful. It's operationally useful. Now, my arguments with Foreign Office over this went on for a whole year before they sacked me. But they never once claimed to me that the material was true. They always stuck to this line, it's operationally useful. Now, I want you to think of the ramifications of that. Intelligence in a war on terror is not judged, is it true or not? Is it useful or not, operationally? Does it paint the picture the government wants to have painted? Mm-hmm. Now, apply that idea to the intelligence on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Was it true? No. Was it operationally useful? You bet, if you wanted to concoct a spurious legal self-defense justification for an entirely illegal war, it was the most operationally useful intelligence they ever had. And I can promise you, as an insider and as someone who was myself the head of the FCO section monitoring Iraqi arms procurement in the first Gulf crisis, I can promise you that the FCO knew bloody well that that dossier on weapons of mass destruction was a load of nonsense. But it was operationally useful. I want you to think as well about when Eliza Manning and Buller claims that there are 1,600 actual Islamic terrorists active in the UK. Not supporters, not sympathisers, not people prepared to give a bedroom or safe haven, but people actually prepared to commit acts of violence. 1,600 Muslim terrorists in the UK, based on intelligence. Is it true? No, total bollocks. That would be 30 times the level of active participants in violence from the Irish, Northern Irish community at the height of the Troubles. It's just a number. It's about 1 in 400 of adult male Muslims in this country. It's a number which anyone with any security background knows is bollocks, basically. But it's operationally useful from their intelligence because it's useful to scare people to put yet more fear into society, to do more to alienate the Muslim community from the British public, to stir up Islamophobia, to justify, remember she made this a week before the Queen's speech, to justify John Reid, who looks more like Mussolini every time I see him, in proposing yet more and more of the kind of draconian legislation that removes human rights in this country. When you hear it's based on intelligence, one thing I want to leave with you is remember that intelligence almost certainly came from somebody screaming in agony in a torture cell in Uzbekistan, in Pakistan, in Algeria, in Egypt, in Syria, in Morocco, in Diego Garcia, in Guantanamo Bay, in Abu Ghraib, in Poland, in one of many, many
Sri Lanka,
many locations around the world. Because that's what we are doing. We are creating. The material I saw in Uzbekistan vastly exaggerated the influence of Al-Qaeda in Central Asia. There was almost no Islamic militancy of a violent kind in Central Asia until we embarked on our policy of strong support for the dictatorship. Then people started to hate us. And that's true around the world. This endless war on terror is a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we keep invading people's countries, 650,000 dead in Iraq. I'm not sure how many of you saw the Martin Bright report in the New Statesman about the party in number 10, in which Tony Blair was asked by someone, with 100,000 dead in Iraq, how can you sleep at night? And he replied, well, actually, I think you'll find it's more like 50,000. You know, we are being conditioned, the public are being conditioned, to think all those dead people were only Muslims and they are out to kill us. And by a whole string of fake plots, the Ricin plot, where the intelligence came from somebody who was tortured in Algeria, as Eliza Manning Buller has publicly said, and it turned out to be completely false. There was no Ricin, there was no plot. The Forest Gate plot, the chemical weapons vest, there's no such weapon. If you want to use a chemical weapon, you go for air dispersal. You don't wrap a chemical around a human torso and swathe it in fabric. The whole idea was nonsense. But because of intelligence about a chemical weapons vest, it was enough to keep anti-Muslim propaganda on the front pages for days and days and days. There have been loads of them. I'm sure you've been hearing today, you know, about 1,200, maybe more now, Muslims arrested under terrorist legislation, hardly anyone charged, virtually no one convicted of anything to do with terrorism. And so much of it goes back to that willingness to employ torturers overseas, to produce lists of false members of Al-Qaeda in this country and elsewhere, to keep stoking the fires of Islamophobia. We've got to resist it. We've got to get the truth out to people. Thank you.
I'd like to ask you a question which might be difficult to answer, but nevertheless is interesting if you could. It's what makes you so different from other British embassy officials. I mean, I speak as an immigration advisor and lawyer, and I have to say my experience of embassies abroad is of the most corroding kind of skepticism, of the most disgusting kind of racism, addressed towards people who are not British citizens. Are there ways in which, for example, immigration workers could approach British embassy officials, assuming that they could be somebody like you, rather than somebody, or is there something different about you? Did you go to a different school? I mean, what, you know, what made you able to respond so, I have to say, heroically and unusually?
Thank you. I don't like people calling me heroic, because I promise you I'm not in many ways. But I think, I mean, I did go to a different school. That is part of it. I went to state school and Dundee University, which for an ambassador is not at all normal. But it's partly to do with the lifestyle. People lead a terribly self-contained lifestyle. They don't want to look outside. And mostly they're not in it because of idealism. They're in it because it's a career and because the money is very good and the lifestyle is amazing. I had 8 servants. I had an indoor swimming pool and an outdoor swimming pool and a sauna and with a separate Turkish bath off the sauna. You know, and that's why the majority of people in the Foreign Office are in the Foreign Office. It's actually mostly one giant outdoor relief scheme for the impoverished members of the aristocracy who otherwise couldn't keep up their lifestyle. Which doesn't mean to say there are no good people. There are some good people. You'd mostly find them in the political sections, and they spend most of their lives building defences to stop people interested in immigration cases getting anywhere near them, because otherwise they'd do nothing else. And I think that's part of the problem. But I'm going to say something a little less flippant, which, I mean, ideally, it's kind of you to say that I've restored your faith in human nature, because I've lost my faith in human nature. I mean, I really was astonished. When Michael Wood gave that legal justification for, you know, we can get intelligence from torture as long as we don't do the torturing ourselves. I've known Michael Wood for 20 years. He's a friend of mine. He's a really nice guy. And I said, how can you switch off your conscience? Michael, you know, we drink together. You're a nice guy. Children are having their testicles cut off in front of their parents. And you're giving a legal justification saying, well, as long as we don't do it ourselves. You know, what the fuck, basically, is going on? And I honestly think what I saw was the way that, you know, Nazi Germany wasn't so different. You can look at all the people working in Abu Ghraib, all the poor people working in Guantanamo Bay. They're not monsters. They're ordinary people like you and me who found themselves in a position where their job tells them to do that. And the truth of the matter is, just like Auschwitz, that 99% of people, when the power structure and the job tells you to do it, it turns out we'll do it. I was stunned. And there's me, Karen Ross, and Elizabeth Wilmshurst, resigned from the Foreign Office over the illegal war in Iraq, out of 4,000 people. And as I say, and to be honest, my truth in human nature is severely shattered and by the experience. And I really do think that I've seen how easy it is for a government to take the government machinery down the road to fascism without anybody complaining. And that's what I think we're fighting now.
Yes. Thank you.
Sir, while we're waiting for the next person, I just wish to correct you one small point, sir. Craig Murray, you're quite mistaken, sir. You are a hero.
Yeah. Peter Carlin from theclimatereport.com. I wanted to ask the former ambassador, do you think the war on terror and its ability to be used in the domestic arena is a primary motivation or a byproduct of it? Or to what extent is the war on terror really something that America and Britain are galvanizing because they have true fear that the Saudi royal family may be on its last legs and their supply of oil may be interrupted?
I can answer. I will read you 3 sentences from a document which I think explains what was actually happening in Uzbekistan, why the American government was giving $500 million in aid a year, and which you can extrapolate into the wider war on terror as to what was really behind the torture and behind the story about al-Qaeda. So a facsimile of a letter from a gentleman you may have heard of, Kenneth L. Lay, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Enron. And it's dated the 3rd of April, 1997. Remember that, 4 years before 9/11, 1997. And it's written to the Honorable George W. Bush, Governor of the State of Texas. 2 sentences. Dear George, you will be meeting with Ambassador Sadiq Safayev, Uzbekistan's ambassador to the United States, on April the 8th. Enron has established an office in Tashkent, and we are negotiating a $2 billion joint venture with Neftigaz of Uzbekistan to develop Uzbekistan's natural gas and transport it to markets in Europe. I know you and Ambassador Safayev will have a productive meeting which will result in a friendship between Texas and Uzbekistan. That was actually what it was all about. That was the that was the substance behind the narrative about supporting the war on terror and inventing Al-Qaeda terrorists that you were fighting jointly. Because in fact, what was going on below were oil and gas contracts. And my experience from 21 years in the diplomatic service, 6 years in the senior management structure of the Foreign Office, is almost always, this isn't abstract, you will find hard contracts and hard money changing hands behind it all.